Welcome to Valhalla Conversations Podcast. I'm your host, Becky Hill, otherwise known as Soul Chaser Becky, and I am a proud Viking geek. I fell in love with the history, culture, and mythology of the Viking Age, and I have been on an endless quest for more ever since. Join me as I discuss all things Norse with those who have been inspired by Viking Age history and Norse mythology in their creative works, or those who have studied the sagas and archaeology, and review how such subjects are being presented to modern audiences today. If you like Viking stuff, you are welcome in my Valhalla, and I hope you stay for the conversation. Welcome everyone to Valhalla Conversations Podcast, episode 14. And for this month's episode, the month of April, I am delighted to welcome a fellow RPG friend and Norse artist, Sam Flegel. Welcome to Valhalla.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Would you mind introducing yourself and telling our guests, viewers and listeners about your wonderful Norse works?
Sure. So I call my Norse series Fateful Signs, which is basically my love of Norse mythology expressed visually over a decade now. And so I've done an illustrated version of the Havamal, and I do oil paintings based on the various stories of the gods and goddesses. If you want to check any of that out, you can go to fatefulsigns.com and you'll see all of that. I have a newsletter where I let people know when new stuff comes out. I have a Patreon for those who want to really dig in. And then I post on YouTube and Instagram. And I even just started a new TikTok. So I'm trying to be where all the cool kids are.
You're braver than me. I haven't dipped my toe in that sea yet. I'm just getting my hang around Instagram Reels, let alone YouTube Shorts.
Well, I've been doing this now for 15 years as a professional artist. Wow. So I've really seen a change. It used to be enough just to post a cool image on Instagram, but these days, just looking at the numbers, video is king. And so I'm just trying to be in all the places where, because you can make one video and then post it everywhere with very little difference. So anyway, that's dipping my toe in the whole video editing thing, which completely, honestly, it really changes how I work, because it's not just about sitting down to draw or paint. Now I got to make sure there's the camera's in the right angle and it's focused on the right thing. Cause I've definitely filmed myself drawing and then you get it back and it focuses on the back of my head leaning into the photo rather than the drawing. It's just, anyway, I've got it all worked out now, but a lot of learning this past year. And I feel like when I set out to be an artist, I never planned to be a video editor, but here we are. Ooh. Welcome to the modern world.
Well, those videos look very well done. I've always enjoyed watching your reels, especially when you talk your way through, because of course you mentioned you've been painting for the Havamal and the Voluspa, which is the prophecy of the Oracle, the seeress that Odin raises from the dead to find out what on earth is going to happen to him and the rest of his family, etc. Of course, the Havamal is the sayings of the High One. Odin's, I think, is directly all from Odin, more or less, is it not?
Yeah, so Har, it's the sayings of Har. Har is the High One, and the High One is Odin. So yeah, I always describe it as, it's like Proverbs from the Bible, but for Vikings, or Poor Richard's Almanac for the Old Norse.
That's a very good way of describing it. I like that.
The thing I love about the Havamal, and I talk to so many people about the Havamal because I have the books and I do comic book conventions and other fantasy conventions. So a lot of people will see the book and go, "What is that?" So I've gotten my spiel pretty good. But the thing I find that's so cool about it is most of the life advice in there is still actually really solid advice. In particular, I really enjoy the section on drinking, because it talks about how when your fellows party, you should party too, but there's also no shame in going to bed. In fact, often the worst things happen when you don't go to bed when you know you should. And I just think, like, man, like, yeah, that's brilliant now, just as it was 1,000 years ago, or, you know, maybe even earlier than that, considering it probably was an oral tradition before it was written down. So I don't know. I always find that stuff really cool. The idea that, you know, we as people haven't really changed all that much, but technology has changed a whole lot, and culture certainly has changed some, largely because of the technology. But at the end of the day, people were just people.
Couldn't have said it better myself, really. That makes so much sense. And I think, I often wonder if that's the allure of the Vikings and the Viking Age, that it feels so alien, so far removed, yet the ideals, the struggles, what we think people struggled with and tried to compete with, whether it was in love, marriage, power, politics, freedom, independence, that kind of thing, those are still things that we practice, live with, experience today. Very much so.
Absolutely. And I also think there's another component, which is if you come from a Germanic speaking people, so both of us, you know, speak mm-hmm. English, and English comes from Old English, which comes from Old Norse. And so there's so much of it just baked right into the language that I know for me, when I first started getting into Norse mythology, I would learn things, and it almost feels like, I don't know, like coming home, or a certain familiarity. It's kind of, for me, it's also rooted in Tolkien. That when you read about the Shire and Bilbo's adventures and you know, Frodo and all that, there's something about it that just feels like you've been there before, or like it's not where you're from, but maybe your grandfather understood it or something along those lines. And I think Tolkien tapped into that same thing that Norse mythology also taps into, which is that the roots of just, you know, home and hearth and adventure, but also rooted in family and community. And so many of those things are just right in the English language and in many Germanic speaking languages.
That is very true. So touching on that point about how, when you first experienced it, how did you first come across Norse mythology, and what drew you in?
So I do get asked this question a lot, and I've definitely thought about it a good bit, and it really goes back to college for me. When I was a young man, I went to Mississippi State University, which for me was out of state. I live in Tennessee, and so I went to a school where I didn't really know anyone. No one from my high school went there, and I was pretty lonely. And so I would go to the library, and at the time I was very interested in mythology and world religion. And so they had a huge section, like most college libraries do, and I was just reading all of the mythologies, not just Norse mythology, but you know, Hindu religion, and you know, Christian and Jewish. And my mother is a Methodist minister, and so I was raised in the church, and so I had lots of questions about, you know, the things that you get taught in church, and then the things that you don't get taught when you're raised in a religious household. And so I just kept digging, and when I read Norse mythology, just like I was talking about earlier, it really felt like coming home, in a way where the other mythologies just felt more like, I don't know, like stories, you know, like mm-hmm. I read Chinese mythology and I think, man, that's cool. But I have a hard time relating to the idea of a celestial bureaucracy. That just doesn't hit me in the heart the same way as, like, you know, the feeling of like a bearded guy looking out into the mist and wondering what creature could come out of that. To me, that it just hits me more in the feels. And so it's always stuck with me after that. And so I at that time I was majoring in graphic design, and I went on to have a career in marketing. I worked as a graphic designer for almost a decade, and then I went on to be an illustrator, and I worked as an illustrator for about 5 or 6 years doing art for game companies before I ever did a painting based on Norse mythology. So there's almost at least a decade, maybe even 12, 13 years between that initial experience and then thinking about, like, I should paint those stories that I love so much. But even through that time, I'd still would read, the various works and the history of it. And I've would get recommended books by friends and just all that. So it stayed with me, but not at the level that the last 10 years where I've started doing the Fateful Science Project, I've really gone in the deep end, and I really haven't come up for air yet. So.
Well, you seem to be swimming well down there in that metaphorical sea.
Yeah, indeed.
So what made you decide to do Fateful Science then? How did that all begin?
So I was very blessed in the first part of my illustration career that once I started getting work professionally, it never seemed to stop for years. And so I was always moving on to the next job, the next project, the next convention, the next commission, until I didn't. And I had a month where suddenly there was just no work. And so for the first time in years, it was like, what do I want to paint just for me? And so the first painting I did in the Fateful Sign, what would become the Fateful Sign series, was Odin's Secrets, which is a painting of Odin holding Mimir's severed head with Hugin and Munin sort of flying in on his shoulders. And at the time, I didn't realize I started a series. It was just me doing a painting. And after finishing the painting, it did pretty well for me online. I even ran a Kickstarter where I sold prints of that painting. And at the time, I raised $1,000, which I thought was pretty cool. I think this was like 2014, 2015. So it was in the very early days of Kickstarter. I was one of the first artists I actually knew to try doing art on Kickstarter. And then eventually I started getting work again. You know, it ended up only being a month or so with that little dry spot. From there, I just would start planning images where, you know, if I had free time, I'd work on another Norse mythology image. And, then I started getting commissions for Norse mythology images. And then I started having enough of it where I was like, you know, I wasn't sure what to call it. And even calling it Fateful Signs didn't happen until I did the illustrated Havamal, where I actually specifically took a month off at the end of a year. So in the month of December, because I wanted to know the Havamal better. And so I thought if I did illustrations based on the poems, for me as a visual learner, that would be a way I could learn the poems personally. And I posted that online, and then that eventually led to a book design. My wife's a graphic designer, so she did all the layouts for the book for me, and then Kickstarter, and you know, it kind of snowballed from there. But the quote comes from the Havamal, where it's the section with Odin's, it's talking about Odin hanging on the tree, and the next line is, runes shalt you find and fateful signs that the king of singers colored and the mighty gods have made. And so the fateful signs is a reference to, and the reddening of the runes is a reference to adding blood to activate the runes, which was a practice that's thought that the seers who used the runes would do in order to add color to them. And so anyway, someone suggested to me that Fateful Signs was a cool name, and it had the reference in the lore and in the poems. And so for a long time I called it like Fateful Signs, the Viking series, but eventually Fateful Signs just became enough of its own thing that I kind of dropped any of the other little bits with it. But yeah, that's where that came from.
Can I ask kind of like what kind of commissioned work did you get in the field of or the area of Norse mythology? Because I'm always curious about who or what wants Norse myth as an image when there's so little imagery of it.
Yeah, so it happened in two different ways. The first is I would get I was a guest at conventions a lot, and part of the deal is often like they'll pay for your hotel and your booth, but they want you to do some art that they can then use on like the magazine or the pamphlets they give out at the convention. They'll use it as a poster. So there's kind of that give and take when you're an artist guest. And so I was an artist guest for a show called the Full Moon Tattoo and Horror Convention. And
oh,
so
wow.
They'd have like, you know, the actor who was in the Jason costume would be there and sign stuff and then tattoos. But it was werewolf themed. And so the second piece I did in the series is The Death of Odin, where I did a picture of Fenris as a werewolf holding Odin's severed head in the piece. So it's kind of a different take on Fenris that fit what they were doing, but also fit my desire to do more Norse images. And then I was an artist guest at a big gaming convention's Origins Game Fair. And so I did a picture of Vidar with a metallic boot that they used on their images. And then the other, the first part of the answer is I would shoehorn other commissions into Norse mythology themed. And then the other type of commissions I were getting were from private collectors who wanted an image. And so a friend of mine now, George, he used to commission a lot of my work, and he wanted to see the binding of Loki. So when they take Loki beneath the earth and tie him to stones. And so
interesting.
If you want to check it out, it's on my website. I did a very detailed depiction of it, where it actually has the one son who's turned into the wolf, who is eating the entrails of his brother, and the entrails are being used to tie Loki down, and Odin is tying Loki down while Thor is holding him in place, and Skadi is placing the snake above his head, and Sigyn is in the background holding a bowl and crying as she looks on at everything that's happening. And so that piece was commissioned by George, and he still has it in his private collection. And then from there, it would just be me creating images I wanted. Now, these days, I'd say the most common commission I get is for tattoos, particularly since I did black and white artwork for the Havamal. That lends itself pretty well to tattoos. And so, I don't want to feel like I'm bragging, but I'd say, 20 to 30 or more people have my art tattooed on their body. And some of them are people I know and who have asked permission, and other people just get it done. I mean, the strangest, not the strangest, but I guess the most surprising story was I was at a convention in Atlanta called Dragon Con. And just to set the scene, we were going to a Mario and Luigi rave. And so it was a dance party where everyone's in Mario.
Nice.
And my wife and I were just going with some friends. So we were just dressed, normal. But I walked in and this guy goes, "Oh man, you're Sam Fliegel," and started taking off his shirt immediately. And so I was like, "I don't know what's about to happen here." And then he turned around and he had a full back piece of my drawing of the world tree from of Odin being hung from the world tree from the Havamal that I had done.
So
yeah, and I was blown away. I got photos, and so that definitely happens, where you know, people just think it's cool, and they want to get it tattooed. And then other people now want me to design custom art in a theme or a character. Recently I had a guy who really liked the image I did of Thor from the Voluspa, where like his legs are actually the goats and he's holding the hammer. He wanted a piece of Odin to match that. So I did a piece where Odin is made up of the rings, ravens, and wolves actually kind of construct his, wow, his body. And I don't know for sure if the guy ever did it, but he was going to get it as a forearm piece. So one on one arm and one on the other. Yeah. Dedication. And I don't have any tattoos personally. I always think it's interesting what people choose or what they feel connected to. The most other thing people commission is, I was commissioned to do a painting of Wayland the Smith, the famous smith who made Beowulf's armor and Siegfried's sword. And he's referenced in the Poetic Edda as well. The Voland section. Mm-hmm. So Wayland. And that was a oil painting I did for a child's bedroom. This young man was being named Wayland, and his father was big into old English stories, and Wayland plays a prominent role in many old English stories. And so they wanted a painting of Wayland the Smith to hang in a baby's room. I have to say that is a first for me. Most people don't think of my art in children's bedrooms, I'd imagine, but so that I thought that was cool. And then people get pieces done because, a friend is named Freya, so they'll want, you know, a Freya piece. Or sometimes it's just certain collectors will collect any of the pieces I do based on, for one, Scotty is pretty common. There's not a whole lot of Scotty imagery out there, but I've done her now. Done one painting and I don't know, five or six drawings. It varies. And I guess it's just that over time, as I became more and more known for doing Norse mythology, people now seek me out or have found me online. Or, I mean, the Havamal's coming up on having been out now for almost 10 years. So,
wow, what an achievement!
I think it was 2016 that we published the Havamal. So yeah, 9 years now. So that's a long time for people to own the book and relate to the different pieces in that. And so then think, you know, maybe they want something. I also find with a lot of art collectors, people will often start by collecting prints, but then they realize pretty quickly that you can fill your house with prints really quickly. And so they switch to maybe, instead of buying a whole bunch of art, they'll spend a little bit more money to buy a drawing, and then maybe over time a painting. And it goes from there. Also, you know, having done it as long as I have, it's also an age thing. You know, people who were 14 or 15 when I started, they're now 30. So that changes as well. And when I got my start, I did zombie portraits at horror conventions, was what I did when I was trying to first break into game art. So I've now experienced, there's a lot of kids I did zombie portraits of who find me online or message me that they had this zombie portrait in their bedroom growing up. And so I find those people as well.
I've never heard of zombie portraits before. That sounds cool, I must admit.
Well, the tagline I would always say is it's like getting your caricature done at the fair, but deader. It was a time. And I really got lucky with that because I started doing the zombie portraits in 2009 and Walking Dead hit television in 2010.
Oh, gosh.
And so there was a 4 or 5 year period there where zombies were very in vogue, and I happened to be able to have a business going, and yeah, that was a long time ago, and it feels almost like a different lifetime. But you know, they were fun, and people enjoyed them, and now those people, you know, are growing up, or you know, we're all a little older, and some of them are into the Norse stuff I'm doing now, and some of them aren't, and that's fine. You know, as you go through life, you shed certain people and pick up new ones, and I'd say that's pretty normal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, going back to the start of the first question about your initial connection with Norse mythology, I relate to you very strongly because I went to sixth form college on my own, and then I went to university on my own. Even at primary school, there was only me and two other students in my year group. We were a very small cohort.
Yeah, that's fine.
I went to one secondary school and I went to the other, and I just always proceeded, strangely enough, further west from where I grew up, which is around the lovely city of York, in North Yorkshire, in England. But I've always just been in books and libraries, so I'm glad that you kind of like found a source of companionship within books and the libraries. So that made me happy.
I've always been a big book lover. My wife as well. It's actually one of the things that led us to make the Hobbemol the way that we did is, obviously, there's lots of versions of the Hobbemol out there, lots of translations, but there, at the time I made it, there weren't any other versions that were just a beautiful book. And so like our book, it has this red cover and a gold emboss for the title and everything. And then my wife, being the designer that she is, made sure it was just laid out beautifully and all the illustrations were displayed well. And I've been told over the years that, of course, some people use my book in ritual because it looks nice, but it's also been featured in weddings for folks who are, you know, doing a Viking themed or a pagan wedding. Mm. And I don't know. I love books that they're not just fun to read, but they also have that visual component where they feel, I don't know. I almost want to say they feel real, but I like love, you know, important.
That's really cool. And I know if you weren't so far across the other side of the world, I would totally buy a copy of Hobbemol. But shipping prices, as they are, it's just,
I recently got asked for someone in England what the shipping would be. And so I've calculated this with only a couple weeks ago. And sadly, my book is $50 and shipping to England is also $50. And that's not me marking up the price at all. That's and that's not even that fast. That's like 2 or 3 week shipping. It's not like it's like 3 day shipping or something. So yeah,
I don't know if that would even include kind of like the duty and taxes that are always getting put, like the what do you call them?
Oh no, you're responsible customs. For that on your end.
Yeah, when you that adds to it all. It's just,
I didn't even think about that, but
it's the one thing that always put me off sourcing from stuff from BioWare, which is where my regular occurrence on this podcast, my Dragon Age Inquisitor jacket hoodie from the first BioWare shop before it got shut down and then rebranded. It's been with me a long time, and it was the first and only thing I've ever really bought from the States as such.
There was a time when I first started, actually when I did the first Kickstarter, international shipping was such a big part of it. It would not have been the success that it was. I shipped so many books to England and, of course, to you know, the Scandinavian and Germany and even Australia. Basically, I mean, Japan as well. There are a lot of art lovers in Japan that like American art. And so, yeah, it was a huge part. In fact, I'd say even like 20% of that project sales came from international support. And in those days, I could ship the book to England for like $15, $18. So, I mean, but it was when... the European Union started doing VIN, where you had like you have to have a number in order to ship to certain countries. And anyway, the governments of the world grew wise to the fact that international shipping was a great way to make money, and that they weren't getting a piece of it. And so now they are, and it is way more complicated.
Yep. And unfortunately, a certain someone in a certain position of power isn't helping that any better either right now. But we will not speak of that particular person anymore. So we've talked a lot about Habermal. I would love to learn more about how you got involved in creatively, of course, in depicting the verses of the Voluspa, the prophecy of the seeress.
Oh, okay. So the Habermal had been out for about 2 years, and you're probably familiar, but for the people listening at home, the Poetic Edda, the first book is the Voluspa, the second book is the Habermal. So I guess as I was reading the Poetic Edda for what to do next, it seemed silly to me to have done book two, but not have done book one. Also, the Voluspa, I'd say the Habermal is probably the most quoted set of poems from Norse mythology, but the Voluspa is a very close second. And it contained, I mean, even I think Snorri in the Prose Edda quotes the Voluspa more than any other set of the poems. So I, you know, wanted to do that. And it was quite a shift, actually. So, you know, talking about the Habermal as being a collection of proverbs or life advice, the Voluspa is a story. There is very much an arc to the Voluspa. It's rooted in, you know, it starts as Odin goes down into hell to resurrect this giantess who's a great seer. And then he demands to know what it is, like, can she prove her knowledge? And so then she proceeds to tell the history of the mythology or the cycle of the Norse lore. And then it gets to the point where Odin's so impressed with her knowledge that he showers her with different gifts and treasures. And then he says, now that I have paid you, I want you to tell me of the future. And of course, that's when she famously tells about Ragnarok and the death of Odin and his fellows, but also the rebirth of the world that will come after that. And so with the Habermal, I think it's like 165 verses, and wow. I did 40-ish, I think maybe 45 illustrations for the Habermal. But with the Voluspa, I put on the challenge of I wanted to illustrate all of the verses. There's only 66, I believe, verses in the Voluspa. It's somewhere, maybe 68. Mm-hmm. Anyway, right around that. And so I wanted to do an illustration for each of the verses. The other thing that's different is with the Habermal, with all the art I'm doing for these books, is I start with ink blobs. So I'll create a smear of lightly watered down ink. And then for the Habermal, I would leave and go and meditate on the verse for that day. And then I'd come back into my studio and look at, you know, anywhere between 10 and 20 different ink blobs and try and figure out which one was speaking to me. And then I'd try to find a drawing inside the ink blob that matched what the verse was trying to say. Whereas with the Voluspa, because it's so much more narrative, story focus, I'd still do the ink blobs, but I would do an ink blob specifically for that verse. So, you know, with it starting with Odin talking to the giantess, I'm still smearing around shapes, but I kind of know, like, I need a giantess, I need a little Odin guy, you know, maybe a guy in a hood or a hat or something. And so I'm still finding extra detail by letting the ink blobs inspire me. But the Voluspa is way more narrative focused. So, you know, when you get to a verse that talks about Fenris breaking free of his bonds, you know, I need a picture of a wolf breaking bonds. And so that's going to inspire what is there. That's how I got started with it. And then it took me quite a bit longer. I did the Habermal in about 6 weeks, all said and done. But the Voluspa took me more like 6 to 8 months just to do the art for. partly because I also, you know, I do it in order. The Havamal, I did jump around a little bit. But the Voluspa, I started with the introduction and then just slowly worked my way through. The other thing that came of it too is once I finished the book, several drawings from the Voluspa inspired oil paintings that I went on to do. The Voluspa has the verse about the world tree, with water white is the great tree wet. And it talks about the deeds of men trickling down the tree. And so I did this image of this drawing with the different globes nestled in the tree and them kind of dripping down into this cosmic pool of water. And that inspired what I have to say is my most successful painting, at least in terms of sales at the very least, which is Yggdrasil World Tree, where I did a full color version of the different worlds nestled in the tree. And the liquid from the worlds is draining out of the tree, or draining out of the worlds down the tree into the cosmic well. And for me, what I took from that verse and that image is this idea that, the fire and ice collide to make the first rivers, the first water. Out of the first water grows the first tree, and all the nine worlds are nestled in that tree. And yet the deeds of gods and men and elves and dwarves comes out of those worlds and trickles down the tree into the well of fate, the well of Urd. And that well then becomes what nourishes the tree. And so I view it as kind of a cycle of life image where, you know, we are birthed within these worlds, but yet it's our deeds that nourish the tree. And so I always put forth the question of consider what deeds you do and how does it nourish our tree?
That's really beautiful. That's really poignant, actually. And it does make me think back to your wonderful skill of skaldic poetry in a bit of a little RPG podcast we both debuted in.
Yeah.
And this is how we met. Because both of us, me and Sam, we played characters in Ian Stuart Sharp, or as I call him, Mr. Vikingverse, his Vikings and Valkyries podcast, which is nearing its end. I think it's got one more episode to go by the time this episode is out there, listeners and viewers. So if you haven't watched it, listen to it, go check it out. I'll pop the link below. He has actually, at the time of this recording, dropped a nice summary of events, or the main reason why the world is so chaotic. Doesn't quite explain why so many of those characters die. We both have quite significant, maybe not significant, but unique deaths between each of us. But it was a lot of fun. I certainly enjoyed it. And I remember saying to you in that episode with Ian that I will definitely have you on my podcast at some point. And I have achieved my goal.
And so you did. And we are here.
As I often say to any people who meet me, that once we have even the slightest connection on Norse myths or Vikings, I say, once you know me, you can't escape. I need people to talk to about these things. And this is why I have this podcast, ladies and gentlemen. So, with the Voluspa then, did that become a kickstarted book when you sought to publicate it as well?
Yes. Absolutely. One of the realities of publishing a book is that it costs somewhere around $10,000 just to print it. And I don't know about you, but I don't typically have an extra $10,000 that my wife is going to be pleased about me spending on a book. That, especially with the first one, not even knowing if it would be successful or if people would want it. And so, we were able to raise money on Kickstarter again with the Voluspa, which paid for the publishing costs and the shipping costs, and then I managed to sell it for years. I'm actually sold out of the Voluspa right now and have been for almost a year now. I had 2,000 copies, so we sold almost all of them, except for the couple I tucked away from my own collection. And so I do plan to release the book again at some point in the future, but I'm uncertain what printing is going to be like exactly. Whether I'd need an American printer. I've used American printers. I've also used Chinese printers and a Mexican printer. And so it's just hard to know how all that's going to pan out. But I will probably end up doing another Kickstarter for the the revised version or the new printing of the Voluspa, whatever that ends up being. But at the moment, I'm really much more focused on finishing up the Locusina project, which is what I've been focused on for actually about a year now of doing another book from the Poetic Edda. But the flinting of Loki, or as I like to call it, the epic rack battle of the gods.
It is. That's always struck out to me as a very particular, very almost human-esque scene. I just almost imagine it as like one big kind of like family argument started off by the bad apple of the family.
Indeed.
And there's one line that's always struck me was when Odin's insulting Bragi, the good of stories, and he called him like, "You're simply mead bench decoration, Bragi. You just sit there and look pretty. You have no real purpose in our entire family or our pantheon. I don't know why Odin keeps you around." And I'm like, that's a really good line, mead bench decoration. It made me think back to like Shakespeare and kind of like making the beast with two backs in Othello, to meaning when Othello was having it off with his lady lover. And I thought that was equally a good line. Honestly, modern language sometimes just can't be that kick-ass in verbal terms, really. So
I've been actually shocked by some of the cutdowns that Loki spits in the Locusina. The one that got me is when talking about Njord, the god of the sea, he actually says that Njord's sisters made a privy of his mouth. And I was just like, I was blown away about the implications of what that would mean. And I still can't believe. And then of course I'm trying to think of like, how do I illustrate that in a way that's not just absolutely vile? But I can kind of see the wordplay there because, you know, sometimes the stream is called a river, you know, and so that a stream also refers to what we do in the bathroom. And so I can see that correlation of, you know, Njord being a river water god, and then the wordplay of another way to break water or make water. And everything that's involved there. But also with Locusina, I like to imagine it as a play being performed for a crowd. And similar to your Shakespeare reference, I just have to imagine, you know, the actor portraying Loki stepping forward and pointing at the actor playing Njord and then saying the line about his sisters using his mouth as a privy, and the crowd just laughing and thinking that's so, you know, hilarious. And that's, you know, a lot of the back and forth. In fact, I mean, I just did a verse where Odin and Loki they're going after each other, and you know, Odin calls Loki unmanly, which of course in Viking society, what would be worse than being unmanly? And so he's unmanly for not just having children, but being the mother of Sleipnir. So, you know, a reference to that story. But then Loki claps back with that Odin is unmanly because he dressed in women's clothing in order to learn women's magic. And so, again, there's just something so funny to me about the visual of, if you imagine these two actors portraying, like, you're unmanly. No, you're unmanly. And, like, the crowd reacting and almost like you would in like a rap battle or a cut down fight between comedians, you know, people being like, ooh, and oh,
yeah.
I don't know. It feels like it'd be such a wonderful theater experience to see the play back and forth. There's also a number of parts of the Locascena where it references things that are not referenced anywhere else in any of the other poems or sources for Norse mythology, which makes the Locascena very unique. Because, I mean, like references to Fenris biting Tyr's hand. I mean, that appears constantly. Like I said before about Loki being the mother of Sleipnir, and like there's certain references, but then there's also a reference in the Locascena to Tyr's wife asking Loki to be the surrogate father of her children. And so raises a number of questions. The first of which is, who is Tyr's wife? We don't know her name. Yes. She's not listed in the goddesses that Snorri writes in the prose Edda.
Yes.
And then also, who wants Loki to be the father of their children and why? What is that story? Like, that seems like a whole misadventure that we just don't know. That's all we have is four little lines in the Locascena and that's it. And then they move on to something
victory,
else.
To the kind of like the position of Odin and Loki calling each other unmanly, yet you think kind of like the actual aspect of men propagating children would be considered quite a high profile aspect. And yet here's Tyr saying, oh, I can't make children, so can you make children for me with my my wife? Is, oh, gosh. I mean, I remember watching your reels, of course, always happy when one pops up at the Locascena. And I remember one specifically about when Odin and Loki were having their spat about manliness, where you kind of elaborate on the point that Odin mentioned how Loki was a milkmaid down on Midgard.
Yeah. So many times.
Like, what? How has this not been used in modern media at all at any point? It's just...
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so much of the Locascena that's really quite funny. And again, I feel the same way. The image of Loki milking a cow as a milkmaid, again, it's just it's good. It's fun. I think that's what's different about the Locascena is it feels like the person writing it is having fun with these stories and with the wordplay, and it's very obvious even to a modern reader. Whereas the Havamal, I mean, it's quite heavy in a lot of its advice. There are a couple of funny verses in there, particularly when it talks about like how to woo a woman. There's a few parts in there that are quite funny, at least by modern standards. But the Voluspa, though, also not very funny. I mean, it's pretty waiting. I mean, it's prophecy. It's not just the future, but it's the twilight of the gods and the destruction of the world. And so it's kind of hard to have a fun romp with that particular apocalyptic concept. Whereas the Locascena, through most of it, it is that sort of like, it's just a drunken cut down fight filled with wordplay and references to many other stories, but a number of those stories we actually don't have. So it's yet another Norse riddle, which I think for a lot of people is why Norse mythology is so much fun, is because there are answers to a lot of things, but there's a lot more questions than there are answers.
It's the lack of, I want to say the word definition, but it's the non-definitive version. There's no core textbook like there is with Christianity, for example, where it's been reviewed and peer-reviewed and said, yep, this happened. We're not including that one. We don't know the selection process or even the compilation process of these stories.
Right.
Because the people who wrote them down didn't leave their name, didn't live what the time they lived, who they were, whether they were male, female, whether they believed in them, whether they didn't. It's something that I'm touching on quite a lot in my own little personal project of my debut academic article, which I'm still previously writing away on is the modern interpretation of Brynhild, but also Valkyries in general within kind of like modern media, but particularly in fantasy fiction.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at how kind of like most people's image of a Valkyrie stems from, of course, Wagner, and the whole cycle of the Rings opera series he's done. And that image is stuck because people are so visual, especially modern society. It is also visual. As you yourself said earlier, video is king. Although I know and respect people who are listening to me on audio, so thank you. Please don't go anywhere yet. But yes, visuals are so strong, whereas like back in the area of the Vikings living and believing, all they had was stories. It was all words, their imagination. And then memory, of course, to remember all these things. I mean, I was even regaling my four-year-old, bless her, she'll probably not remember this, but I will, impressing her with the fact that, did you know that many thousands of years ago, there was a man in Iceland who could remember all the laws, and there was a lot of them. I couldn't give her an exact number. She was very impressed.
Indeed.
Not really at all. I can't even remember why I was referencing it, but sometimes I have thrown things at her of Nordic stuff. I mean, in terms of the goddesses that you've mentioned, like Tyr's wife, there are so many female figures, not just the goddesses, but kind of vulvas, witches, giantesses, seeresses. I mean, we don't even know the story of the giantess that Odin raised. We just know she was dead at the time. Yeah. We have no idea her life and why she was who she was.
Me calling her a giantess, I'd say is not 100% certain in the lore. So that's just the interpretation I chose to go with. And there are scholars who think that that's probably true, considering a lot of the knowledge she has comes from a time when there were only giants running around the world. But even that is not a 100%.
I really liked, though, the visual image you present of the Loki Center being a performance piece. I really, really, really connect with that, especially if only because it made me think back to, I think it is one of the Thor films, I think it's the second one, where he goes back and finds that Loki's been pretending to be Odin the entire time.
Oh, yeah, and they're doing a play.
Loki gets a play about himself.
Yeah.
I thought, you know what? Yeah, that actually fits. It really does.
We do have references to, in the Mead Hall culture, that reciting poems was considered a very manly thing to do, particularly if you were drinking, to see who could recite the most poetry while somewhat inebriated, or just, you know, to perform for the hall. I mean, the role of scald, and lore keeper. Memory was something, I mean, it's valued a great deal in multiple parts of Viking culture, but I mean, even in modern culture, we value people that have good memories and are able to conjure information. It's just now, I guess, they'd be on Jeopardy instead of performing in the Mead Hall. But talking about the Valkyrie, I'm actually the painting I'm working on right now is another depiction I've done of a Valkyrie that I'm calling Chooser of the Slain, that specifically deals with the idea referenced by the, I believe it was Tacitus, the Roman historian, about the women that would go through the prisoners and select the ones that were to be sacrificed after the battle, and that they were called the Choosers of the Slain. And then, of course, about 800-900 years later, we have references to Valkyrie meaning chooser of the slain. And so there is this sort of curious question of, you know, are Valkyries something different, or did it evolve from this role that the Romans were observing? And then also there's the possibility that it was just Roman hogwash, and that they were just making it up to make the Vikings seem really dangerous or, you know, scary. And so I just think it's an interesting parallel to draw, whether, again, we actually have the actual answer or not.
It is. I think that's what's always drawn me to the character of the Valkyrie ever since I came across I think the first Valkyrie book I read was by a New Zealand, I think, author. She published it independently called T.J. Ayer, and she wrote a book for young adults, because I was a late teenager back then, called Dead Radiance. And it, the way she interpreted kind of like the aspects of how Valkyries choose the dead and the dying, she put it into a very modern context with it being a young adult novel. It's about a teenager in today, not back in the olden days, as they call it. Well, it's the olden days, I suppose. But she depicts them having sight that can see when someone's about to die and that person beginning to glow. Mm. And when they get really bright, and that's, it means it's their time, they eventually die and then they go and pick them. But her entire exploration, or her vision of Asgard and Odin and how the Valkyries work and almost like the culture and their roles was interesting. And I thought, you know what, I want to know more. So I did start researching more. And a bit like you, I started actually looking at Norse mythology properly in my college years during my A-levels. I got out books of Norse mythology, wrote down kind of like family trees of all the gods, wrote down all the bits about the worlds, legends to look up and read. But Valkyries always kind of like, it was always a small bit. There was never a lot there. We have like a series of names that are named in the Grimnismal or the Poetic Edda, and they are often translated as lots of battle associated things, which makes sense because they're often paired with scenes of war and death. Although it's now made me think, is there any Valkyrie that doesn't, I guess they don't touch any of the dead, that dire straw death, as they used to call it, or from illness or from old age, because I assume they just sink to the floor and go down to hell. Like is the stereotypical depiction of. But yeah, there's this gap in knowledge. I think that's a real boon to creatives such as yourself, because there is no rule book. No one can say, aha, they did not have golden wings, or they did not have purple wings, or they did not have wings at all, because some of them do and some of them don't in the many Valkyrie books I read, which is interesting. Sure.
Yeah, I typically do mine with black wings to associate them with ravens. Mm-hmm. But they're often commonly associated with swans, obviously. Mm-hmm. Brunhild turning into the swan and all that. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the most two common birds that they're associated with. But as far as visual interpretation, I mean, even just look at how many different ways have people done angels, the winged creatures that do have quite a bit more written about them. Yet, you know, there's thousands, you know, sometimes they have wings of fire and, you know, sometimes they're just pretty white dove wings, but, sometimes they're like, you know, little cherub wings. And so there's so many different ways to dig into, even when things are described more. But yes, you're absolutely right that in Norse mythology, part of the allure is getting to fill in the details that have been left out. It's something I seek in my work a lot, actually, is what I call the in-between moments. It's what's happening, not so much directly in the text, but what's implied that might happen next or right before, that sort of thing. Just looking for, I think it's because there's so many, as we talked before, the humanity of the Vikings comes through, that's what I'm actually searching for in my work is, I want to connect with modern people, and I want them to look at my image and have it evoke a feeling that they understand from their own life, even if, or even in spite of, the myth or story that it might be referencing. So if you are a lore head, you're going to look at my work and probably see a little bit more than someone who's not, but I try to just create beautiful or evocative imagery that speaks to the human experience with an eye and a nod towards the Norse lore, but more specifically to what it means to be now. A common kind of example. An example I can give is I have a piece called Freya Resists. Mm. And she's golden, and there's all these gnarled hands reaching for her and grabbing at her. And that piece was originally inspired by the Voluspa, where it talks about the giant who is building the wall of Asgard desires Freya as the prize.
Hmm.
And of course, we know that that's not how that story goes, but there's many, many stories throughout the lore that put Freya forward as a prize when she doesn't want to be.
Hmm.
And I know for me, that painting was a lot about a time in my life when I felt like all these different things were pulling me in 1,000 different directions. And I just, it was all I could do to keep standing up and pushing forward. But the piece, I'm told by a lot of women who see it, that to them, they identify as being a person that a lot of people are physically desire or grabbing at, be it everything from like your kids tugging at your pant leg all the way up to, people who have more of a perhaps nefarious interest in controlling you or taking some piece of you. And so it's a piece that I do sell a lot to women, but that's not why I made the piece.
Mm.
But I think that that's what's so cool about art is there's this almost, I don't know, it's almost like telepathy where I put an emotion into a painting that draws from the emotion implied by the story that it's from, and this idea of Freya as the prize, and then modern women see it and they see something else that feels so human and makes them feel like someone is seeing into their soul. And I just don't know of any other medium where that's possible, outside of the arts, because I didn't talk to these people. I'm not explaining, when they see the image and I see them react, particularly if I'm at a place where I'm displaying my art publicly, that's really powerful. And that's just one example. But I find it's important in my art to, you do want to answer some questions, but you also want to leave space for the viewer to step into the work and make and finish the story and make their own assumptions and have their own feelings and their own emotional reactions to things.
Mm.
Because what I really want, aside from the connection, is I want someone else to look at the painting and think of it as theirs and want to, take it home and put it up on their wall and have it remind them of a moment or a time in their life or something that connects deeply personal. And the only way I know how to do that is to bring my own personal experience into the stories that I'm trying to use as inspiration for the various images that I make.
That rings so true on so many levels. And I know I personally have always been drawn to pretty things. And before my four-year-old took over the second biggest room in the house, I did have my own Becky Geeky Corner, which was full of pictures of either framed comic books I've had signed, usually of Mighty Thor or Jane Foster Valkyrie, for example. But of kind of like of Norse arcs, I supported a nice British artist called Asa Wheatley, who made this brilliant, currently on four volumes of a Shield Maiden comic anthology. And he works with different artists, but he's the writer behind it, and it's amazing. And I've always kind of like some of the pin art that we get, and like, oh, that one, that's striking, that one's fearsome, that one's emotional, that one's heartbreaking. And as you say, it's nice that not only does the mythology allow it to be moldable and adaptable to different times and meanings and causes and movements and eras of great significance, but also you as artists allow us as consumers, viewers, content, engagement, as I suppose those who engage with content, to add our own interpretation and not feel that it's wrong or right, but make it have that connection. And of course, art is always about interpretation. I mean, isn't there that famous dude that decided to put a banana on a wall in a gallery, and people kept declaring, "Oh, look at that piece! That banana speaks to me." But it just shows how we're always looking for patterns, for symbolism, for meaning. And
yeah,
again, that's why I think that really partners well with the gaps that we have in the world. As much as it pains us, especially I know me and several other academics and scholars wish we knew more about the female deities and the creatures and those stories. There must have been stories about them because people knew their names.
Yes.
That those stories were lost. But we're grateful for the ones that have survived. And I'm sure a skald back in the 10th century would never have thought that 1,000-odd-plus years later, his stories would still be told, although he probably could correct us on a few things.
Indeed.
So you've mentioned about painting Odin and Fenrir, and you say you've been working on, is it a new portrait of a Valkyrie or new one?
Yeah.
Fabulous. Okay, is there any other gods or goddesses or Norse creatures that you have painted or want to paint?
Oh, goodness. I don't like to reveal too much about
keep secrets. It's all good.
It's not just about keeping secrets. I actually can reveal a little bit about the process with this question. There is a thing where when you talk about something, your mind feels like it's partially done that thing. And so I've grown very careful about talking too much about things I might paint in the future, because sometimes I feel like I already have, and then it makes me less motivated to get the work out there. So it can be quite demotivating, because your minds are weird, you know. Just like I said it, but I mean, I'm always looking at the different stories, and I keep a notebook of things I'm working on. The main thing right now is I have actually finished all of the art except for one piece I want to change for the Locust Senna.
And really?
So there's 65 verses for the Locust Senna, plus a pretty big prose introduction and a prose outro. And I've done illustrations for all of that. And so now I'm in the process. So I spent the last year doing those drawings and filming myself as I was doing it. And so now I'm in the process of releasing that stuff out to the world, because I find creatively it's very hard to make something and then release it too quickly. I need to let it, you know, kind of sit. A lot of times you come back, or I come back the next day, and I'm like, oh, that's not actually done. I thought it was done yesterday because it was the end of the day and I wanted to be done. But now I'm back, I've slept on it, and, you know, I need to revise some things. I'm sure all the writers and anyone who has anything creative in their job at all can relate to that feeling. So it's no different with art. So I've learned that I can release things too quickly. Now, the other is also possible. You can keep all your secrets till the end of time and not show it to anyone, and that's not good either. At some point, you just have to say it's done and get it out into the world. But at the moment, I'm focused on getting the videos out for the Locust Senna, and you know, it's roughly 60 pieces of art, and I'm not even halfway done with the videos yet. So it will be something that consumes me for quite a long time. And ultimately, my wife and I are planning on doing another book and doing a Kickstarter for the Locust Senna and releasing all of that stuff out into the world as well. And so if that's something people are interested in, my newsletter is the best way to be alerted when that's all happening. But I've been encouraged. I did a convention about 3 weeks ago now, and several people came up to me at the convention saying similar to things that you've said as we're talking here, that they enjoyed the reels or the shorts, and that they were wondering when the book was coming out. And so it's nice to know that people are watching. A lot of times when I release stuff, it just feels like it goes off into the ether, and you know, you don't never get feedback, but it's cool that people are digging it. So you know, fingers crossed that funding works out and printing works out and everything comes together. But that's my main focus at the moment, is taking all of the art and then turning it into an actual digestible product that people can have and hold and enjoy.
Cool. I'm going to then pick your brain a little bit about Loki, of course, as a character, because he is definitely kind of, he surpassed even Marvel's expectations as a popular god slash giant. Thor was a great popular character for ages. Of course, Loki was the malicious, maleficent villain in comics going back from the 1960s when Thor first came out. But of course, with Thor Ragnarok and Tom Hiddleston's classic Britishness, I don't know why he was Brits, we just seem to do all the best villains. I'm not sure why. It must be the accent, I always think. but he's certainly become a popular icon of the pantheon, strangely enough. Although I'm sure if Odin was around, he would say otherwise. Or show his displeasure in some form or another. So have you ever come across people who've been fans of Loki in modern media wanting to know more about Loki by watching your reels and seeing how, or asking you about Loki sent? Have you ever had that?
So connection? I definitely encounter people that identify strongly with Loki. I've done some paintings of Loki, and so I get asked what Loki stuff I have. But it's sometimes that comes from people who like Tom Hiddleston and the movies, or Hiddleston. And but I don't know, because I've just as often had people like be in a Loki costume from Marvel at a Comic-Con and just walk past my booth and not even look at it. So, you know, there's definitely people that are just into Loki, Marvel, and, you know, they don't care as much. And then there are others that the stories from Marvel sparks an interest in the real stories and the actual lore. But I do see more and more, I almost feel like the people that are fans of Loki skew younger as well. But that's entirely conjecture on my part. I don't know. I've not done a survey or anything, but there is something about Loki that appeals to modern audiences. I don't know if it's because he's thought of as misunderstood by a lot of people, whereas in the lore, he ranges from mischievous to outright, you know, dastardly and lying and breaking promises and things that are quite evil in the stories. But I think it's also, there's something about him changing shape, changing gender, being both father and mother of monsters, and how that relates to modern understandings of gender that I think people relate to. Although, I mean, the idea of gods swapping gender is something that appears in a lot of different mythologies. So that's not something that's unique to Norse mythology. But yeah, I don't know. The thing that I like Loki, but I also am very cautious of Loki. You know, I do have a mischievous side, and I think we all have had the experience, or at least I certainly have, of getting involved in a bit of mischief that really came back to bite me in the end, and I should have known better. And Loki seems to forever be telling that story again and again and again. But I find that I've never, you know, outside of the stories, I never feel particularly like being involved with Loki. Like, I wouldn't want him as a business partner. I don't want to sign any contracts with the guy. You know, seems like it would be very dangerous. But there are people drawn to, I don't know, that chaos. You know, yeah, I'm not sure. What do you see there? Because you're asking the question.
Well, I think it's because it's obviously we both have had an affinity, a passion for these stories for a lot longer than Marvel have been telling stories of Loki, for at least, sure, because he's only been around for the last 10, 15 years. Gosh, that does make me feel old now.
Speaking about me, you mean in the movies?
Yes, certainly, yeah, in the movies, because that's where he's really struck a chord. Sure. But I know, personally, after I discovered more of the stories of the pantheon and their rise and their fall, but of course see how Loki and of course members of his family are treated because of, yes, he does turn into a female horse, he does give birth to Sleipnir, but he also has other children, albeit monstrous children. He has Hel, half dead, half alive, Fenrir the wolf, Jormungandr the serpent, and the fact that they're all taken away from him, albeit not with his legitimate wife, because his real wife is Signy, and she has two sons, but they don't see much of him because he's always off doing his own thing. It's definitely lent into the sphere, the very growing sphere around Loki, certainly within books, I find, around him as not quite necessarily justified in wanting literally to bring down the judgment of the gods, but they've like certainly
tragically misunderstood.
Yes, they've explored the tragedy of why he is the way he is. And I think that's the brilliant thing that humanity always seem to want to do. We don't just always paint people black and white, but then we want to know the grey before the person became the bad guy. I mean, I was at the Orbit Viking Festival this February, and there was a brilliant storyteller there, a guy called Jason Buck, and he told this wonderful old Icelandic tale set in the 12th century. It was definitely after Christianization, but he explained that his protagonist is always doesn't switch from good to evil. It's a step by step towards evil, and they're small steps, but they get you there eventually until you don't realize you're evil, and then that's it. Yeah. I thought that was a really good explanation of the transformation of Loki from being the character of mischief and causing trouble just for the sake of it to being the Avenger and bringing vengeance to the gods and causing Ragnarok and all that kind of thing. So you're almost modern society in some medium certainly is trying to uncover the pity and the sympathy and the empathy, build an empathy for him that wasn't there before. Certainly in the original Thor Marvel comics, he's just dastardly evil right throughout with a wicked laugh and cackles and master plans and I will curse you, Thor, and bring down humanity, blah, blah, blah. It's a real switch. And at my debut conference at Stavanger last August, there was a wonderful academic called Kevin. I can't remember your surname, Kevin, apologies. But he did a nice exploration of Loki's character transformation in the Marvel TV series of Loki, particularly in the second series. Now, I'm going to spoil it for everyone because I haven't watched it. Have you watched it, Sam?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Okay, cool. So then you'll kind of know that Loki at some point becomes literally the god of stories, the god of multiple endings, alternative endings. And that really fits with his ability to disrupt or change things. I thought that was a really clever way of seeing it. it especially brought me back to another book that I read by Joanne Harris, because she's done two, not one, but two retellings in fantasy fiction from Loki's point of view. In Loki's voice, he is pretty much the narrator from start to finish. And he has a sharp tongue in that one as well. And he literally describes history as being his story. And this is my story, which is why it's a mystery. So it's not the old man, as in Odin, telling the story, it's, isn't it? And I just like how we are. It's almost like akin to the kind of like the whole underdog persona, kind of like you don't want the champion to always be the stronger one. You want to be the one that actually overcome challenge, overcome defeat, overcome the emotional stability. Basically, you don't want to root for the Goliath because he's big and strong. You want to root for David because he's the little guy and he represents you. It's like you mentioned Lord of the Rings, Samwise Gamgee. He is literally the epitome of the common human folk. And my first boyfriend, going back to when I really was a wee teenager, he was quite into Lord of the Rings. I remember getting him a VHS. Now, for viewers and listeners who don't know what a VHS is, Google it. It was a black box. It's what films used to be on, otherwise known as a video cassette. And that was a really interesting explanation of the history of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit as a story. And they did touch on how Middle Earth is just named after Midgard. I was like, oh, it's got Vikings in it. I like it now. So, it was an interesting, and of course, various characters of Lord of the Rings come straight from the poetic Edda, such as Gandalf the Grey, Bilbo the Hobbit, Thorin Oakenshield, and most of his company are all named as dwarves in the poetic Edda. The fact that Norse mythology has infiltrated so many creative forms, it's literally got a transmedia entity. It just moves through time and space wherever the human imagination can take it, and it adapts to every era and time. It's just phenomenal, as you can tell, because I've been puppeting.
Right. I certainly agree with your enthusiasm.
Thank you.
It inspired. You had mentioned Wagner earlier. I don't know. Like, I sort of think of Wagner as the soundtrack to World War II. And I'm certain that Wagner didn't realize when he was writing Flight of the Valkyries that it would be put with that famous video of the planes flying in and, you know, cue the music. It's just another example of that sort of ancient Germanic culture inspiring the media of the time, which happened to be opera. I believe that it was Wagner that inspired some of Tolkien's interest in the Viking stories as well. So it just keeps peeling back the layers.
Because I'm wondering, have you ever read much non-fiction in terms of the study, adaptation, or indeed interpretation of Norse mythology?
Yes.
I'd be curious to know, what books have you read?
Put me on the spot. I'd almost need to go and grab my library. The One-Eyed God and the History of the Indo-European Manorbunda.
I've not heard of that one.
Which is a pretty famous dissertation on the idea of Odin as a god of young men who are in a phase of life where they're going out like packs of wolves in the woods, and then also connects the idea of the wolf god or the dog as a symbol of death and where that comes from. I read an academic paper talking about Uller and his connection to the oath rings. I did a painting on this. There's a place in Sweden called Ulve, which means Uller's Vey. Vey is a holy place. And so there's lots of place names for Uller, but very little surviving knowledge of Uller outside of like the god of the snowshoe. But then there's also famously the reference, I believe in the Heimskringla, that when Odin leaves Asgard, Uller steps forward as the god of winter. And so if Uller is king for a time, that certainly implies a level of prominence that he doesn't experience at the time the Prose Edda is being written, but referencing something earlier. But anyway, to go back in this archaeology study that they did, they found, I can't remember, there was like 30 or 60 oath rings that had been buried at Ulaveh.
Yes.
And so the writer was drawing a parallel to Uller as the holder of the oath for that time period, and also perhaps Uller having a connection to the sun and the disc of the ring being connected with the shape of the sun or the sun wheel. And I'd encourage people to look it up. I actually reference the paper on my website. If you click on the image of Uller the Oath Holder, you can get a direct connection. I'm not remembering it off the top of my head. But I've read a number of books and papers and dissertations on the history. And there are paintings of mine that are absolutely inspired as much by the historic and archaeological side of the study of these things, as some of my paintings are a bit more drawn to the fantastical and more story-based side of them.
So I found the book that I wondered if you'd read, which is From Asgard to Valhalla by Heather O'Donoghue.
No, that one doesn't ring a bell.
It's a recommended read. It's actually, she brought it out as a second edition last summer, because obviously things with modern media have changed a bit. So she had a lot to insert. But it's called, literally, its subtitle is The Remarkable History of the Norse Myths. And it's like, it speaks to my soul, because it says everything I think of and agree with, and more that I didn't know as well. So yes, I do recommend that to anyone who wants to have a toe dip, as you say, into the incredible adaptability of Norse mythology. I will put a link, or at least I'll put the details down in the blurb below for viewers and listeners. Gosh, look at the time. Time is flying, and we are indeed in different time zones. So at some point, I need to get to bed, and Sam needs to go be with his family for the evening. So I will wrap this episode now. I could quite happily talk to you for a lot longer, Sam.
Showing
fun. You're not next door neighbours. Although you might curse me after that if that was the case. But I really appreciate your time coming onto the podcast this month, and I wish you luck with the rest of your artwork, and of course, bringing hopefully Lucky Sinner to the world. I will certainly be throwing money at it as soon as you launch that Kickstarter. I have signed up to your newsletter, so I look forward to learning more. And I, of course, encourage everyone to go check Sam Fleagle out at FatefulScience.com.
Oh, thank you so much, Becky. This was very fun. I enjoyed it. You're a delight to talk with. It's not too many people. Usually when I start going on about Norse mythology, my friends just sort of glaze over. So
that's why I set this podcast up, because I have very few friends. I mean, one of my mum friends is like, who's Thor? How do we know about him? And I'm like, how do we know about Thor? Gosh, where to begin with that one? So yes. But I often find that once people of Norse mightiness connect, there is a very strong connection, and we all always seem to find each other in various ways, thanks to the wonder of the internet and podcasting. Here we are. So I am pleased and honoured and really glad that you joined me on my little humble pet project of a podcast.
No, it was fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam. We shall speak again soon. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussions between my special guests and myself. Please do check out the episode blurb for links to their works and websites. If you liked this episode, let me know by giving it a thumbs up. Let me know if you learned something new in the comments. And of course, click subscribe to Valhalla Conversations wherever you are listening or watching. This podcast can be watched on YouTube and YouTube Music, and it can also be listened to on Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, and on RSS.com. We hope you can join us in Valhalla again soon for more conversations.